You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Thursday, March 15, 2018. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, contributing editor of The Nation magazine, journalist Liza Featherstone, on her book, Divining Desire, Focus Groups and the Culture of Consultation. Also on the program today, the Senate passes the Dodd-Frank rollback on the 10th anniversary of the implosion of Bear Stearns. Meanwhile, Trump brags about lies he told to foreign leaders, and hundreds, maybe thousands, certainly thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of students walk out of their classrooms yesterday in protest of gun violence. A half a dozen White House officials seem to be on the chopping block, as does FBI Director Andrew McCabe. Meanwhile, U.S., France, and Germany now say Russia was likely responsible for the nerve gas attack in the UK, which sent 23 Russian diplomats packing. Republicans reeling from the results in Pennsylvania's 18th district. And the Theranos founder was charged with massive fraud and had to give back a small portion of what she stole. Larry Kudlow, Trump's new top economic advisor, so wrong, he has to be right. And Trump's cabinet, the ones who haven't been fired, have been living quite large, ladies and gentlemen. And lastly, a Trump wall builder hopeful, guy who applied to build Trump's wall, see-through, got to be see-through.
Best people.
Charged with a mosque bombing in Minnesota. All this and more on today's program. Did Mike send us the clip of Connor Lamb? I wanted to play a clip of his speech. We'll play that in the fun half, because he had a pretty good. I didn't catch it initially. In fact, I guess I haven't been on since the win in Pennsylvania the other night. And obviously a big deal, but the implications of that win from now until November are not huge in terms of one more Democratic congressperson. His district will be gone as of November. He will be in a new district that is closer to 50-50. In terms of its partisan index. And I know he, I believe, has a challenger, a ostensibly more progressive challenger in that district. So that is something we will talk about down the road. But the implications of this election in Pennsylvania have more to do with the impact it has on Republicans, because there's nowhere for them to go after this, electorally anyways, because Donald Trump came to town, didn't have any impact. Like I said, it was like as if Gallagher 2 came into town. People went out. They caught the show. Gallagher 2 comes to town. You're not going to miss that, because he's doing all the stuff that Gallagher 1 does, but probably at a 15% discount in terms of the cost. So you go to see Gallagher 2. great show doesn't impact whether or not you go out and vote. Or doesn't impact whether other people go out and vote. People don't care if I've seen Gallagher 2 and there's an election the next day. There's no relevance. And that's what apparently was happening with Trump. But Connor Lamb was running against Paul Ryan in this election. They tried, the Republicans, to talk about their tax cuts, and then they stopped 2 weeks out because it wasn't working. They poured millions of dollars in. I don't know how much they ended up outspending Connor Lamb and outside expenditures, but it was at least a factor of 4 or 5, is my understanding. They certainly can't afford to put that much money in most races, certainly not the 120-some-odd that are more blue than this district. So the question becomes, like, what do you do? And apparently that's creating a lot of dissension within the Republican Party. I feel horrible about that. But here is Connor Lamb. Do we have this segment where he talks about Medicare and... Okay, yeah, let's...
We went everywhere. We talked to everyone. We invited everyone in. And we found that there is public support for programs like Social Security and Medicare that's nearly universal because these programs are universal. They are America's way of saying, we are all in this together.
Now, that's and obviously, I mean, I think people who listen to this program for any period of time know that I love to hear things like that, particularly in terms of Social Security and Medicare. But this is a guy who you can anticipate. On guns, he's somewhere between Manchin and Toomey. On abortion, he's somewhere around like where, I guess, presumably Harry Reid was and others, maybe even John Kerry. I'm not personally for it, but I wouldn't legislate against it. But this is also a guy you can anticipate moving to the left. His district is going to become more blue. And so he's already there on economics, on social issues. You can imagine some drift to the left. But that statement about finding out over the course of the campaign, I don't know whether or not it's true, but that's the way he's presenting it, that these programs have universal appeal because they are universal in nature, bodes well for a guy coming to the conclusion that Medicare for all is the right way to go. It's not there yet, but the foundation has been laden.
I want to say that was a good use of lane.
Thank you.
Yeah, and as a pro-choice person, I just want to say, if someone is personally opposed to abortion but doesn't want to legislate it out of existence by banning it, they're pro-choice.
Right. Right. Exactly. That's the whole point of pro-choice. All right, Let's do this before we've got a couple of moments here. I want to remind you, obviously, that this program relies on its members for its existence. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you do, we give you the fun half as a way of saying thank you. But that doesn't mean that we keep all the fun in the fun half. Here's Sean Hannity reacting. And yesterday, I had the privilege of being I got a notice from my kid's school a couple of weeks ago that the administration was aware that students were planning to walk out of school on March 14th. This was obviously announced nationally, and different school, like the kids and the student government or student council decided that's what they were going to do. They said, we don't know how many students are going to walk out. We are not going to do anything to facilitate this, but we also will not stop them. teachers in classes will stay in classes. So that in the event that there are any students who want to stay in class, that they're going to stay in class. But, and as we're not going to facilitate this, we may have some, we're going to have teachers who are not in class stand outside to make sure that the kids are safe. But if you're, you know, a parent, you can come down there and basically stand on a street corner just to make sure that the kids are safe. Do so. So I was out there. Hundreds of kids marched. And I have to say, if you know anything about middle school kids, to have even a moment where they are quiet is stunning and in some ways really poignant. And these kids marched around a full city block without really saying a word. They had signs. Maybe they were whispering to each other, but it was quiet. It was eerily quiet, and it was pretty poignant. Now, of course, this is a horrible offense to someone like Sean Hannity and the conservatives, because, you know, children are meant to be seen, not heard. Now, of course, even though this was a silent, they were silent. Not just not heard. You're just also not supposed to see them. But here's Sean Hannity complaining about it.
I'll tell you what's pretty disgraceful today. There's a headline, teachers unions, and you've got all these other groups of people out there. You got Pocahontas. By the way, why wouldn't Elizabeth Warren get one of those ancestry tests? Ancestry was an advertiser on this program for a period of time. I actually
wonder if Ancestry wants to be associated with mocking people's background. That'd be an interesting question for folks out there to ask Ancestry if they want to really be associated in that way. But let's hear Sean Hannity brag about how purebred he is.
Past. And it's pretty cool. I mean, if you want to find out what your heritage is, your background is. In my case, it came back. It was something that I thought I already knew, but you don't always know. 100% Irish or 100% British Isles is how they defined it. And I think those tests are amazing because, you know, maybe you have this, you didn't know you had that relative, this relative. It doesn't, you know, it's kind of cool. They were shocked because very few people come back 100% like I did. That apparently is not normal.
Yeah, it's not normal. It's called inbreeding, and it's probably what's responsible for the particular look that Sean Hannity has. It's a little like his forehead, I think, is a little bit slanted a little bit. But and maybe it explains his ease with thought. Let's put it that way. He's not bright, but good.
Shocked because very few people come back 100% like I did. That apparently is not normal. I'm like, oh, okay, well, whatever, but it's interesting to find out. But I knew all four of my grandparents came to America, and none of them had any money, for the record. But anyway,
all related before marriage.
All these kids, you know, Planned Parenthood, the Women's March, Pocahontas, Elizabeth Warren, who won't take the test, but she says she's not running for president, probably is running for president. They're all behind. I watched these students walking out today to change the gun laws, and it's pretty despicable that people, so many people, feel that they have a right to indoctrinate our kids. You know, so they're trying to get, you know, young 14, 15, 16-year-old kids to vote Democrat in the fall. That's all this effort really is.
For those people whose ancestors inbred and you came out 100% of something, let me explain this. If you are a 14, 15, or 16-year-old in March, by the time the fall comes around, you're not going to be able to legally vote in this country because you need to be 18. So in other words, to go from the age 14, 15, or 16, you will need more than 8 months to get to age 18 where you're legal to vote. So I just want to make that clear, because it's obvious that, I mean, people who are 100% purebred don't necessarily always. My understanding, they also have problems with their hips. Yeah. It's the purebreds.
Are you sure about that? I know math isn't really our strong suit.
No, our math is not our strong suit here, but I'm quite sure of that.
Hannity was so psyched to get 100%.
So psyched.
How long?
I don't want to brag about it, but they said we're really surprised.
If he had Native Indigenous ancestry, he would not have mentioned it.
Yeah, I mean, I have a feeling it was probably like 98%. He just figured to lop off the 2%. You can round up.
How long until Ancestry.com is forced to disavow all the milk-chugging anime Nazis who are using it to prove their racial purity?
I hope it's soon. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Liza Featherstone about her book, Divining Desire, Focus Groups and the Culture of Consultation. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. A pleasure to welcome to the program for the first time, I believe, contributing editor to The Nation, journalist Liza Featherstone, author of, well, her latest is A Divining Desire, Focus Groups, and the Culture of Consultation. I have here in my hand. Liza, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
So let's start with what the origin of focus groups were.
Sure. Well, their origins would surprise most people. They really come out of social democratic politics. In the sense that these qualitative methods were first developed in the context of Viennese socialism, because the leaders in socialist Vienna really, as the social scientist Paul Lazarsfeld, who came out of that milieu, said later, he said, we had to understand why our propaganda was unsuccessful. They had to understand why not all of their messages were being embraced by the working class. But the focus group itself, so they developed many different approaches to what we now call qualitative research, which basically means listening to people talk. But the focus group itself was later developed by Paul Lazarsfeld as he was a part of a group of Columbia University researchers who were working for the Roosevelt administration, trying to understand a similar problem, why its propaganda was unsuccessful. The administration was trying to convince Americans to make the sacrifices necessary to enter World War II. And contrary to what we think, what we assume now, Americans weren't very interested in entering this global conflict. And in the context of listening in groups to the Roosevelt administration's propaganda, Lazarsfeld was able to help them figure out why. And in the process, much more lastingly, developed this practice of talking about things in groups and really focusing on a specific text, hence the term focus.
The story about what it was about the Nazis that it's a side note, but it's interesting. When the Nazis were spoken of as being sort of dangerous, people's response was like, okay, yeah, I don't want to mess with them.
No way. We want to stay as far away from these horrible, scary people as possible. Yeah, the Roosevelt administration had in their propaganda, which is since some of these failed campaigns were quite spectacular with these sort of really demonic, scary-looking people who look barely human, and really emphasized their mercilessness and sadism towards civilians, and Americans were like, no, thank you. We would rather stay home and leave these people to their own devices. What Lazarsfeld and his colleagues discovered was that that when the propaganda emphasized, in contrast to the Nazis, we Americans have a democratic system. It's more rational and enlightened, emphasizing the positive message of, let's defend our way of life, then people were much more responsive.
I mean, it's interesting, and maybe this, again, is a little bit tangential, but in terms of the United States, one would have, I mean, that doesn't, it's a little bit surprising, but then when you think about the American history up to that point, the notion of manifest destiny and the idea of American exceptionalism, that's basically that was a selling tool up, largely up to that point, and, a selling tool to this day.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And it's also, we continue to see elites sometimes overestimating the power of a message of fear as opposed to a message of, we're all in this together and, doing great things, which in the latter is often a better message that people will respond better to. But absolutely. And in fact, at that time, because of the Cold War, which of course came next, American elites were very much in transition about what kind of story to tell Americans about themselves. But at that time, at World War II, a very uplifting message about what kind of society we were was widely appealing.
I want to talk about how focus groups evolved through time, at least in the United States. But before we get there, how were, even back in Vienna, and when we talk about Red Vienna, we're talking about essentially the 1920s, maybe a little bit
That's
of the
right.
1919, the teens,
the 20s.
And maybe the 30s, but
Absolutely.
It's basically the 20s. How sensitive were the people who were running these focus groups or doing these, I guess I don't want to call them a listening tour, but how sensitive were they to the idea of getting like a demographic representation, and particularly in the context of the United States? Like, I'm curious as to when they were doing those things, particularly in the United States, it's like, well, you know, we can just get a bunch of white people because at the end of the day, that's who we have to really convince, know, as opposed to sort of like broadly representative, you know, white males, basically. We don't really have to spend too much time fastening a message that's going to appeal to other people because they don't necessarily have, they're not necessarily as relevant. I mean, how did they navigate the demographics? How conscious were they of that?
Well, interestingly, I mean, demographics have always been a lot more emphasized in polling than in focus groups. I mean, in polling over the course of the 20th century, issues of demographics and representation become really salient really quickly, you know, like because people start to understand that a poll is not meaningful unless if large parts of the population are being excluded. But of course, it takes a while for elite pollsters to figure this out. But it becomes very salient in qualitative research. The issue of representation has always been a little bit murky because. It's not really what qualitative research does best, you know. And market researchers often are amused because clients will say, "Well, we want a really representative sample," you know. And the market researchers will say, "Well, a focus group isn't a representative sample. It's just 12 people. And if you do 100 focus groups, that's still not a representative sample." Like, I mean, it's still like, you know, the value of it is you get a bunch of people in the room and you hear about their ideas in depth. And it almost doesn't matter who they are. I mean, because because it's not going to be a representative sample, no matter what. It's but what is interesting on the sort of, well, do we just have to listen to white males? No, very quickly, the focus group becomes a way for. The elite white men making decisions in whether in advertising, marketing, you know, or you know, product development, it very quickly becomes a way for them to reach the people who are not in those decision-making positions because they actually really needed to know a lot more about, for example, how women felt about things. You know, how do women feel about dish soap? How do women feel about household cleaning products? Because nobody in the room, you know, in their corporate decision-making spaces. Is using dish soap,
right.
Or is, you know, is using these products. They start to talk to black women. You know, they are wanting to sell things to black women, but there are no black women in their company, you know, in any decision-making position. So, you know, it becomes all the more. It actually becomes all the more important to include people in focus groups, the less power those people actually have in business and, of course, later politics.
Well, that's the thing is that I find interesting. And again, we'll get to the evolution in a moment because the difference between the sort of like the selling of or the I guess the testing of a political message versus say the, you know, finding out stuff about how people use or, you know, you use the example of Betty Crocker in the book. I mean, which is interesting in and of itself. And maybe I'd like you to just to tell that story because it is interesting. But the you don't need a demographic sample. All you need to do is hear the different people's perspective on how they use the product, because it's all it's all centered around the the use of the product becomes far more relevant than other attributes. In politics, I would imagine that's different, right? Because if you want to get a perspective on how women writ large are receiving a certain political message, you got to make sure that you have at least some diversity of perspectives within the umbrella of women, I guess, right?
You do, and you do you do make sure that your group represents a number of different perspectives, and you know, not just white people, but you also you are primarily you are primarily listening to focus groups to get a perspective, and you know that they can never fully represent the population.
Right.
You know, so that's something that is sort of their whole value is this is how some people feel. there is no way that focus groups can ever tell you how everybody feels. And in some sense, that's one of the reasons that while most people love participating in focus groups, they hate the idea of them, because people always feel unrepresented by the focus group, you know, because by definition, you know, they didn't ask me, you know.
So so it starts with the use of the focus groups starts in the political realm, the idea of how are we going to sell the American public on getting involved in World War II, and then it migrates pretty rapidly, I guess, in the post-war era to Madison Avenue. Tell us how track for us through, you know, I guess the 50s, the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, aughts, where the focus group goes.
Sure. Well, you're right. It very quickly moves to Madison Avenue, in part because many of the very PhD students who worked with Lazarsfeld at Columbia go into Madison Avenue and bring the method with them, because they can see the commercial potential of it. As well, it's perfect timing for the focus group because companies are at this moment frantic to figure out how to get the American public to consume more. As soon as World War II ends, it's time to get the economy moving again, replace the wartime industries with other kinds of economic activity, and get people who have been making sacrifices to stop sacrificing and start spending money. So this takes an enormous campaign of persuasion, and the focus group is ready to step right in and help. So we see enormous boom in market research in the 50s and the 60s as well. And it's really buoyed by the boom in consumerism at that time, and then also by the Cold War, because there's a need by corporate America and by elites in general to sort of have a general persuasion campaign about the merits of our system. Our system is so great because you can buy all these consumer products. It's better than communism because you can buy so much nice stuff. There are multiple persuasion needs that are being satisfied there. In in the 70s, it becomes particularly useful because corporate elites are under such an onslaught of criticism by political activists and such facing so much cynicism by the general population. So advertising is criticized for being sexist. So there's a lot of listening to women in this period. Corporate elites are criticized for selling stuff that is dangerous, like tobacco and cars that are not safely made. There's just a lot. The more corporate America is criticized, the more persuasion is, the more listening is needed to figure out how to do a better job of persuading people that things are okay and that people should still listen to what companies have to say and what companies want to sell them.
Is that also a function of an awareness? And we should say that. In the 50s, there was also this sort of pushback about this type of marketing that was, subliminal. And I just remember it in the context of of a kid hearing about it as like they were supposedly in movie theaters. They had discovered that there was that they had put like pictures of soda when they showed a popcorn or something like that, like for like a fraction of a second that made everybody in the theater go buy, Coke or something. And there was a big pushback to this.
It's important to say that that was not true.
That was the myth. That was that in like Pop Rocks, believed. I think, would blow up in your face or something.
Yes,
like that.
It was widely believed, and it was a part. It was an important part of the pushback against market research in the 50s. Yes, absolutely. There was a huge backlash against market research in that period. The most one of the most dramatic sort of critiques, really tapping into the zeitgeist of hostility and skepticism to it was Vance Packard's book, The Hidden Persuaders. And while if you read carefully, he acknowledges that the subliminal messaging thing was not quite true. His book really fans the hysteria around it, nonetheless, by constantly implying that this is what advertisers are up to, and there was a lot of anxiety about the psychological approaches. There was a great deal of use of psychoanalysis in market research at this time, and people, Americans were really curious about psychoanalysis, but also really creeped out by it and creeped out by the idea that that corporations could understand their feelings and desires in such intimate ways
and manipulate them.
Yeah.
Now if I remember correctly too, that this guy Bernays, who was responsible, I think, for putting a cigarette in the mouth of like a suffragette marchers, maybe it was, Sigmund Freud's like first cousin, if I remember correctly.
Nephew. Yeah, he was Freud's nephew, which is a really fun fact, and is not so surprising given there were just so many connections between psychoanalysis and market research in this period. Ernest Dichter is somebody who is also claimed to have invented the focus group, although he didn't. But he was a Viennese psychoanalyst who then makes a very decent living doing market research in the 50s. It's interesting because in that period, the the critics like Packard are really worried that people are going to be manipulated by all this stuff. And the and when you read the advertising industry's response to critics like Packard in this period, they almost sound ahead of their time in the sense that they're the companies are the ones saying, well, actually, we think women are smart enough not to fall for all this stuff, and that's why like it's just so hard to sell them stuff, and that's why we have to do all this market research. You know, I mean, it's like there's actually kind of almost a lot more respect for the female consumer's intelligence coming out of the industry side than there is from some of these social critics, and that's.
Well, I mean, at least that's
a little dynamic as well.
That's the rhetoric, anyways, right? I mean,
it's the rhetoric,
right?
Yeah.
They don't. I mean, I think there's. I'm a little bit dubious that they. I mean, advertisers have always said, like, we think these people are much smarter than you give them credit for. We're going to spend millions of dollars on manipulating them. So.
But it's true, but I think the I think, in some sense, yes, and of course, that's very that's very cynical of them. But on the other hand, I also think that in this period, you see a from critics like Packard, the beginnings of a critique of advertising and marketing. From the left that that it kind of starts us off on a bad foot. I think. I mean, it starts us off on a bit of like overvaluing of some of this messaging, and I think the sort of myth of subliminal messaging is a good example of that, because that's just something that was not true, and a little bit of a little bit of undervaluing of the you know the general intelligence of people.
So how does this migrate into politics in terms of messaging? At what point does this become a staple? I mean, I you know, as recently as the other day, in fact, Matt, our producer here, was getting into it with Andy Slavitt, who is the head, I can't remember, of what the healthcare initiative is. It seems to have already gone away. At least in terms of press. But one of the things that they were in their messaging was, I think it was universal access to healthcare. And Matt had commented that that term is almost automatically disqualifying from the perspective of anybody who's actually interested in delivery of healthcare. And I don't want to litigate that. But he did come back and say, well, this term was reappropriated or was appropriated by the right. And I suggested to him on Twitter, then maybe it's a bad term to use. And he came back and said, well, it focus tested well. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was very odd because, I mean, you run a risk of getting the wrong people in the room when you're doing that type of thing, right? Like, because it's one thing if everybody in there is using a product and you're finding out how people use a product, but it's another thing to see how people receive a message, because that is much more wide open, it seems to me, and much more open to the narrow experiences of that person than it would be as to how I use dish soap.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Then there are many more ways of viewing any political issue than there are probably of experiencing your dish soap. But So the focus groups really become prevalent in politics in the 1980s. That's when we really see the reverse migration in this period, where a lot of people who have made their mark in consumer research enter politics or take on political campaigns as part of their business, and they see the messaging project as essentially the same. You know, that you are listening to people and figuring out how to sell them products. You know, just in this case, the products are political candidates and political messages.
But isn't there a difference here between saying, okay, we're going to go into this room and we're going to hear what comes out of this room. We're going to create a word cloud out of these 12 people who are talking about what they want out of, let's say, healthcare, just for the sake of argument. As mm-hmm. opposed to, what do you think about this word? Or what do mm-hmm. you think about you know, this idea? Which is different, right? I mean, it's one thing to mm-hmm. sort of like actually have it be listened, you know, to listen mm-hmm. to people open-ended. It's another to sort of like feed them things. I'm not saying that people are trying to manipulate the results, but it seems to me that's a fundamentally different a project. Even though you have, it's still a focus group, but testing something versus just listening and seeing what's floating out there seem to me to be two different things.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it is, but the fact that they are that they are treated as so much the same thing, and that consumer products, you know, and political candidates are basically market researched in exactly the same way, using really the same methods, I think that the reason that that's possible is that by this time, you know, the late 20th century to the present, to the period we're still living in, people are really viewed as passive recipients of their political system in the same way that we are passive recipients of toothpaste. And it's, I mean, in my opinion, it's fine that we're passive recipients of what's on the market in our toothpaste, because who cares? But we are really reduced to an entirely consulting role in our politics, we're really not as ordinary people fundamentally influencing the direction of anything, and that's why it makes sense for the method to be the same.
Well, it's a fascinating book, Divining Desire, Focus Groups, and the Culture of Consultation. Eliza Featherstone, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks a lot. My pleasure.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will, we've got all sorts of sound, some wonderful sound. Hearing Dana Perino. You recall that Dana Perino was the press secretary for the Bush administration. I can't remember if she came in late. I remember there was Tony Snow. I can't remember if he was before or after her. There was a couple others. But surprisingly, she's defending the torture program.
She was there at some relevant moments.
I would imagine. You know what? We're going to play this right now. Because when we ask of our audience to irritate people and they go out and do it, we're going to celebrate this. So here is some footage of Sebastian Gorka, who was heading to, he was in, I believe it was in Oregon. Is that correct? Salem, Ohio. Okay. And that's right, Salem, Ohio. And he was going to speak to, I think, some local Republicans there. And there was one protester out in front of the place that he was going to speak. And here he is. He is, I guess we'll call him Spearberry on Twitter. I don't want to give his full name, although I think it's out there. But that's not the type of guy I am. And here he is. He's some distance from Gorka, but here it is.
Gorka, I know you can hear me. You're not a real doctor.
Once you get a job.
Good one. Sebastian Gorka, you're not a real doctor. Didn't even look at me.
There you go. And the best is that, like, that I don't know if he was the Columbia County Republican Party chair, but he walked by the Spearberry and told him to get a real job. Let's play it one more time because I really enjoyed Gorka just walking in there. I mean, imagine going all the way to Salem, Ohio, and having someone say this to you. I love it.
Gorka! I know you can hear me. You're not a real doctor. Good one.
Why does he think he doesn't have a job?
That's just their first go-to.
Yeah.
It's just ready there on Hair Trigger.
I almost feel like we should have paid him to do that. And so he could have said, this is my job today. Yeah. It's the gig economy.
A king's welcome.
Yes. I'll block you on Twitter. You're blocked. All right, we're going to take a quick break. The number is 646-257-3920. Matt and Jamie are here. Michael's out today. Michael's, I don't know if he was partying too much last night. I don't know what happened, but he couldn't come in. Michael's on a photo shoot. All right, going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We've got plenty of sound. We'll take your phone calls and your IMs. Right back after this.